Hey everybody, this is the Brew Shaman for Crafted For You. I'm here with my crew as usual.
Hey guys, it's Alyssa.
I'm Chris Nielsen.
And we are in Charlotte today on a sweltering 94 degree...
It's a warm day outside.
Very warm.
Day in Charlotte.
Which makes drinking beer all the more refreshing.
And we are at one of our favorite breweries today. We are here at Noda Brewing Company, and we are sitting down with the head brewer.
That's me, Chad Henderson, also co-owner.
That's got to be very exciting, too.
It is exciting, because it's a little title, so it's really
yes.
That's pretty cool.
You get excited to hand people business cards?
Like, it doesn't say co-owner on the business card yet. I haven't really actually run out of my head brewer one, so.
Yeah.
We're actually at the new facility today.
Yes, they have two facilities.
1 mile apart from each other. We got our original spot that opened up in October 11th of 2011, October 29th of 2011. And this one opened up in October 1st of 2015. So we're a mile apart. We have both facilities still running. And
You guys still brew at the other one still?
Yeah, we brew a lot of the other one actually still. We do a lot of our side batches. We have an extensively larger selection of beers this year than we have in the past, if you already have had a pretty large variety to begin with. So we added the new spot predominantly to make our big market beers available at much more high capacity without having to try to catch up to them all the time. Right now, as it stands, we have 7 year-round beers, which is a large rainbow.
Yeah. Wow, that's a lot.
We have our Jam Session Pale Ale, our Hop Drop and Roll IPA. We have our Par 4 Session IPA, which is a new one that came in recently. We have the Woody Wilcox IPA. We have the Coco Loco Robust Porter with coconut and coke nibs in it, and we have the Cabu Blonde Ale. So we have a pretty wide variety of year-rounders, which takes a lot just to keep up with that with one facility on a 50-barrel system. And then we have pseudo seasonals, and then we have like really major seasonals. And the major seasonals like the Noda Hito, which I'm drinking right now. We can brew on this. Our new system is 60-barrel brew house, so it's 4 times the size of our old place. So in order for us to do a little bit more than what we did last year, it would take us several weeks of brewing Noda Hito, whereas this time we brew it like one day, and then like a month later we'll do it another day, and then a month later we'll do it another day. And so it's like one day we can dedicate to it and do like basically a full batch day at the old spot. So it allows us to push out the ones that we knew we were going to go far with and sell really fast, and then we can keep the old place to do kind of niche, like rare, weird beers or stuff that, like, you know, people have had before, but it's not like a super featured season. Like our pumpkin beer, Gorgeous, like it flies out in the cans like crazy. So it's like, I'm brewing that tomorrow and we'll knock out 240 barrels of that right away. And then a couple weeks later, we'll do another 240 barrels of it. So you have, you know, 8,000 gallons at a time, fill it up.
Yeah.
Whereas we could do a simple little, well, not simple, but like Monstro. So like, you know, our Russian Imperial Bourbon Barrel Aged Molasses Coconut Stout. AKA adjective stuff. and like, you know, we did that at the old place and we have to do it in reduced batches, so it's just so high gravity.
Yeah.
So we did about like 45 barrels of that, making what, compared to the original time we did Monstro, a huge increase in potential packaging, but still super limited compared to like what we're going to do with Gorgeous.
Right.
So we had like our major seasonal and then like our little limited release beer. And we did the Goodwill Hoppings at the old place and stuff like that. All like little side project beers that are super limited. They get basically brewed over there because we can do, you know, 20 to 40 kegs of it and be done. You know, that's like, here it is, have at. You know?
Yeah.
Whereas over here is like, you know, we can do several hundred keg run / thousands of cans at a time off of a much more easy and more, I guess, best way to accountable system is the best way to put it. Because, you know, like over here on the new system, we have so many things that that can give us readouts that we didn't have readout for at the old spot. So the old spot is like when you're lottering from mash tun to lottery tun, it's like, how'd the lotter go? It's like, good.
You can't even know.
Yeah, it flowed there in under a long period of time, you know. And it's like over here, it's like, oh yeah, the differential pressure stayed below 3 the entire time, and we maintained an 18 to 21 gallon per minute rate of lotter, and never had to cut rates or low rates or anything like that. It's like, oh cool, this is numbers that we can
actually know what happened.
Batch to batch to batch. We're like, well, this is why this one fucked up, because something, you know, obviously caused a higher DP spike or whatever. So, you know, it's when we're trying to make beers to regularly go out over and over again, you know, it's easier to do it on a system that can give you some sort of like massive readout over and over.
Right.
So when you're doing like a one-off, variance is not that heavy. And I know everyone will sit there and compare Monstros to Monstros, and it's like, if you can remember what you had I can't remember what Monstro tasted like the first time I had it popped open, like to the point where I can analyze the new Monstro.
Right.
I'd be like, the new Monstro is pretty damn good.
That's part of the fun of those beers anyway. Yeah. Is being able to be like, well, it's not the same, it's different.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Everyone kind of gets a little bit on the soapbox when they're talking about like consistencies and stuff. I'm like, this is craft beer. Consistency is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
No matter how big you build your facility and everything like that. So.
Yeah, you don't have billions of dollars like the big guys do. You can't just like throw away a batch of beer.
Yeah, people still make beer here, not just robots that are just like hit the start button on them. You know?
Yep.
we still haul a lot of bags of grain and stuff like that. Like with this heat, we don't have a whole lot of ventilation and, you know, circulation of air and stuff. Like right now in this room alone, this is nice compared to what it's like on the brew stand.
Yeah.
We sweat ourselves pretty hard in the brewery. But that's the whole thing. Like with actually really less number of brewers now than what we had at the old place, we can accomplish four times the volume. So, you know, it just goes as you scale up.
Yeah.
There's more automation in process. If I had no automation on this new system, then there's no way I would still be alive today. I could not go up and down that
No,
platform.
Yeah.
How many times to turn all the different valves and run up and turn this other valve and have this pump off, and it'd be a huge amount of waste, or I would just die midway through the days. I couldn't do it. So you'd have to just hook me up to a constant like hydration machine or something like that. It'd be too much.
So a little camelback strapped to
the
back.
Yeah,
something.
Exactly. With nutrients and everything. It's dying right now as we speak.
Like a beer, like one side the beer, one side the water.
Yeah, exactly.
Depending.
You gotta keep me equally numbed and hydrated at the same time.
It's all about balance. That
exactly.
Yeah.
It's everything in life.
Well, so it seems like you guys are doing well. We just walked past a massive wall of beer on the way coming through here, all the cans.
Oh, yeah. We have a new canning line here now, and comparatively to what we were doing at the old place, we'd have we contracted out a Wild Goose line that would roll in and set up and run there, and then we actually replaced that with our own cast 5-head filler, and it runs like 20, 22 cans a minute. This one runs, this Livinger is a 30-head carousel style, and it'll do 100 to 141 cans a minute. So significantly more.
Yeah.
And so you need to have all those pallets ready to load
up
and roll out. And also people don't understand, like one of the greatest things about cans is, our whole reason to go with cans, like from day one, I was like, we should do cans. Because back when, like, you know, 6 years ago when we were thinking about opening Noda, no one had cans in the Charlotte market at all. I'm like, that will pop, you know, that will look different on a shelf. And also, if it's a 16-ounce size, that's going to look different to what other cans look like anyways.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that, like, you buy a pint at the tap room, you can get a pint in the can. You know, this is an idea, and it's full can labeling and everything. But the best part about it is that it kind of promotes, like, the whole, like, craft beer being part of kind of, like, an active young lifestyle.
Yeah.
Because you can take it hiking. You can take it
to the beach.
To the beach. You can
take
it to the pool.
You
can take it places that bottles can't go. But the other big thing that's a real good plus on the can side that a lot of people don't realize is a nice business feature is the fact that you can buy bottles individually, like bottle case individually, but like no one's going to do that. But like you can buy a pallet of bottles. You know, no one buys a pallet of cans, you know, so, or they do buy a pallet of cans, but they buy like truckloads of cans, basically.
Right.
And everyone's like, well, that's a huge investment right away. It's like, but the problem, the thing that's good about cans is that they don't weigh anything. I can grab a 12-foot tall stack of cans and just grab it with my hand and shift it around on the floor. They weigh nothing.
Yeah.
So in shipping costs, you save a ton. So
yeah,
what we do, we saw those walls and walls of hop drop cans. It's like they have the die cast for that can. They spin them out in trailer amounts at a time.
Yeah.
So we're like, well,
that's
take rent. You know,
yeah.
So it'll rise in this huge amount. And people are like, oh, it's so many cans. It's like, yeah, but we'll knock through that couple weeks.
Yep.
You know, it's better to have it on hand and you know, save on the shipping than to have a truck come in and out every other day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just unload a pallet or two of cans and be done with it. So yeah, we like having them. And also it's a cool looking wall.
Yeah. That's great.
Which about, it blows my mind when I occasionally take people back here and they're like, oh, I want to take one. It's like, it's empty. It's like, well, you just like sit out in like room temperature at 90 degrees with like this can, like, you know, this like, you know, I don't know, it's like 20 some odd high, like with no packing around it or anything. It's like, if you can stack cans like that, you have some sort of witchcraft that, you know, we don't need in here. There's no way cans can stack like that unless they're empty.
Oh, man. Where do you draw your inspiration for when you're coming up with new beers? Like, you were mentioning that you guys do a lot of, like, one-offs.
It's difficult. Now, it was really easy back in the day because, you know, you just have that whole, like, green, you wanted to see this or that in the scene forever, and that's where I come from is promoting craft beer in Charlotte. I've been here for almost 10 years, and when I came down here initially, basically besides Rock Bottom, which is the brew pub down in Uptown, which is part of a kind of a chain of breweries, there wasn't really any beer to be spoken of in Charlotte. Brawley's had basically the only spot where you could get really good imported beer, and Common Market soon became a place to get good craft stuff and everything like that. But the idea of, like, Charlotte having its own identity as a brewery city just wasn't there. And it didn't make any sense because Charlotte's the biggest city in North Carolina, and you had Asheville just 2 hours up the road that had all these breweries springing up, and you had a good, solid brewery springing up in the Triangle area and even in the Triad, too. There was an identity to it. And Charlotte was just like an import taker. And so I kept, like, advertising and promoting. I'm from the medical industry, so I was working not in the beer industry before, but all my free time I spent basically trying to educate Charlottesians about craft beer and beer pairings and stuff like that, and taking what little knowledge I would have and the growing knowledge from that to try to tell people, you know, if you think Guinness is the only dark beer out there, you're wrong, and there's a lot better dark beer. No knock on Guinness. They'll probably assassinate me in the middle of this. But, you know, it's like, you know, there's other options out there. It's not just that. When I moved to Charlotte, like, if a bar had Sam Adams on it, it was like, that was a crazy weird craft beer bar. Like, you'd see, like, it had Delirium Tremens on. It was like, oh, man. It's like, it's a standard.
Shiner here?
Yeah, it's insane. But, you know, now that Charlotte has its own, like, you know, founded breweries, the local bar scene sees the benefit of having craft. So, like, places that you would, like, when we first started out, there was, like, these are the places we have to be in, like the Duckworths and the Revolutions and the Pizza Peels and all the Flying Saucers and stuff like that. They were the guys that, before craft beer was really the big thing in Charlotte, they were still doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and so they were the places first. And then you started seeing the places that you would never go to for craft beer, like, yeah, we want all locals, huh?
Yeah,
because like, they know that, like, Charlotte's a big transit spot. So, like, basically it was this breaking point where you had all these people coming into town from other cities that had awesome craft beer. Mm-hmm. They're like, what the hell? Where's all of our, you know, where's
some beers?
We had imports like Dogfish Head and Ape. Ever since the cap popped, we had good representation. They were just speckled and hard to find. But, you know, Founders was really prevalent here. Sierra Nevada was really prevalent. You know, Bell's was really prevalent. So they had their pockets, and they would have all these really cool beers. And I'm like, I want a Charlotte brewery to do something like this. Like, Ramble on Red and Notarized, which were our first and third beer we ever brewed, were heavily inspired by beers like the Founders Red Rye and stuff like that. And it's like, you get inspired by stuff that's out in the market that you want to kind of make your own iteration of, like the 90-minute IPA from Dogfish Head, and like the, you know, the Centennial. I had a love affair with the Hop Centennial just because of how much I love the Founders Centennial IPA, you know, and also Two Hearted for that matter.
Oh, yeah.
So for a while, Two Hearted was kind of like the king of like the hoppier beers for the introductory beer drinker here in Charlotte. Yeah. So, you know, it's like, you know, there was this like kind of like, I guess, unveiling of, like, there's this seedy underworld of craft beer. And so when it came to starting our own brews, like, I want to do these sorts of things, you know, and stuff like that. And as time went on, and it didn't take long, it was like, we got to throw our own weird X factors in. So doing things like coconut porter and doing, like, the Notajito started as a joke. it really did, because, like, when we first started out, like, I had worked a ton of beer festivals, and what, like, Joel Armato, or Dr. Joel, as he's commonly called, he's one of the sales managers for New Holland, was at the time when I was hanging out with him a lot, was the sales rep for New Holland in our area, and he covered, like, multiple states, and I would go and help him pour every now and then when he would do a festival in the Carolinas or whatever. And I would just volunteer, and it's like, it's one of those things, like, hey, I actually know craft beer. I'm just going to volunteer and just pour a handle. Like, I'll talk to them about it. I know every stat that you'll allow me to know and ingredient or whatever. So it was kind of, there was a few of us that were just like these really big beer nerdy guys in Charlotte that would just constantly go and like work these festivals for free /admission/drinks or whatever, to go preach the word out with these different breweries that we really liked. And Joel had this great thing, so, you know, Dragon's Milk was not a commonly found thing in Charlotte. And you can see it in every, you know, beer that sells, place that sells craft beer now, and kudos to him for it. But, like, you know, back when it was, like, super limited, and they didn't have a production to really make it saturate here, he'd sit there and write on a board, you know, it would be pouring, like, Poet and Mad Hatter and like what was another one that we would do a lot of, like Pilgrim's Dole or something like that, and they'd be like Dragon's Milk tap set 307. And it's like be here, it's like dance party will ensue, and I'm like, why 307? He's like, they'll never forget 307. It's like that is such a specific time, this must be super important. And he's just gonna pop in bottles of it, just pouring it, and I just saw a guy standing there with the boombox, no one could even hear it because everyone was just screaming, like holding their glasses up. It was just like the hype parade of it all.
That's great.
And I was like, that's genius, and everyone's gonna freaking remember that. And the same thing Foothills did a lot with Sexual Chocolate, and it would be that it was like at this time this super rare beer is gonna pop, like kick off, and it was a very new thing in beer festivals. Because at the time you were used to just seeing like Shock Top would be here next to this bourbon guy, next to this barbecue guy or whatever, and it's just a big sampling of stuff you can probably easily find. You just may have not had it before and you just walk past a bunch of time in the aisle. This is like, you're never gonna find this in the store. It's the one and only one of this. So when we first started out,
like an underground record.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's just a big, it was a great hype thing, and it builds excitement for your brand and stuff like that. I was like, that's genius, I love that idea. So when we first started, I started doing festivals, it was in the fall and winter time, so I was like, let's make a s'more porter, because that prior year at JBF, one of the beers I really liked was this graham cracker porter that I think it was Denver Brewing Company made, and I was like, that's a cool idea. So I mashed a ton of graham crackers in a porter and then basically did like lactose sugar. I didn't throw marshmallows in or anything, but lactose sugar, alpha nibs, cinnamon, ginger, stuff like that. And basically just made this, and it had smoked malt in it, so it actually had like a campfire-y character.
Oh, nice.
I made a couple of batches of that on our little pilot system. This is like one keg at a time. And so through the winter, it'd be like, s'more porter tap set, 702. We were doing videos for this stuff. It was like me and Matt, who started out as our assistant brewer, is actually one of our production managers now, been with us from the beginning. Me and him sitting there like doing the s'more thing, like from the Sandlot. It's like, hey, do you want a s'more? it's like s'more what? So stuff like that. We'd had like the pitches for that to advertise it, and people would go crazy for it. And it wasn't anything that. It was a little 5% porter or whatever. But it was the fact that it was like a limited thing. So when Notohito got born, Notohito was born is. When it came down to the summer festivals, I was like, I don't really think people want a smoked, chocolate cinnamon graham cracker porter in the middle of a music festival outside at 110 degrees.
Yeah,
heat index.
Yeah.
Bart, who does majority of the brewing over at our original spot now, actually, came in and he was like, oh, my girlfriend said we should make a mojito beer, and he kind of like laughed it off, and I was like, that's it, because at the time I was like, we need like a mint beer of some sort. And when he said mojito, I was like, that's it, mint and lime, let's do it on whipped beer. And so we made this thing, and Todd, when the founders came in, and he's like, what are you doing? Like, we're doing something sciencey. Stirring it, throw mint in, and Todd's like, all right, whatever. and so we put it on draft. We made 2 5-gallon kegs, and we put one at the Gastonia Grizzlies Festival, which is at the baseball field in Gastonia, and they have a part where if they the brewers and the drinkers get to vote on their favorite beer of the festival, and that beer gets basically served at the ballpark throughout the entire season. That's kind of like the win. It's like, oh, we'll buy this indefinitely. And so so we brought one there, and then one at the Royal Hill Brewers and Music Festival. And people were just going nuts for it, because it was like super refreshing and awesome. But it was made as a joke. It was like, yeah, it's a mojito beer, Notohito, yeah. Get it? And that was it. And then like, so we're serving around at the ballpark, and it ends up winning like the drinker's choice. So like, oh crap, now we gotta make this thing on production. And so it became a seasonal kind of by force. So, stuff like that. And it's just like, there's just random things, like the whole New England IPA thing's been a new thing recently. And we made the Goodwill Hopping as that. I want to make like a one that actually has like fruit in it and call it Gary Juicy. Stuff like, just random little things like puns or like just how you feel at the moment. I have a lot of stuff backlogged from just like listening to a certain song or whatever. Like I always say that, I always equate brewing beer to making music, because like my dad's a musician and stuff like that. So I think that's way more applicable than cooking. It's like, yeah, I get it. It's grain and whatever. Yeast is in there. But it's like, I look at it more so it's like all the products of that make the beer, kind of like all your different instruments, and it's how you orchestrate them together with the different techniques of how they come together to create something. Like, you don't need a name to a beer, you don't need a description on a beer, whatever. You can fully express a beer through just drinking it without knowing any other thing about it. Just like you can hear a song that has no lyrics and you never get hear, you never tell it. And like the song "O Fortuna," you know, aside from the opera people singing it, you know, whatever, it's like one of the most climatic like movie theme songs of all time, and half the people don't even know what it's called, but it's in like 20,000 movies.
But you hear it,
it's like every epic like battle scene, like it's like going in every commercial that has like some like slow mo running thing plays it, and it's like, you know, you don't need to know what that's called, you don't need to know any of the lyrics to it, but you can feel the same like righteous like dramatic character from it. So it's like, so making beer to me is kind of like the same thing. Like you just want to emote something, whether you're inspired by something amazing or very specific or like an occasion, or it's just like happy or sad, right? And it just happens to fit. So there's no like, there's no rhyme to reason for it. It's just, I'm kind of forced to constantly keep it rotating or take inspiration or ask other people to come up with stuff, because we have a, we have to do it every week for a notable. We do a small batch every single week. So, you know, and we've been doing it since day one, which is exhausting. So, and we never repeat them. So it's really hard to keep new ideas going.
It's good though. It's forced innovation.
Yeah, it is forced innovation. Well, it's nice because it keeps it, it's majority of the time it keeps the creative wheels lubricated, and you know, you see something or you hear something and you're like, oh, beer idea, you know, like it kind of like immediately like makes you like go like, you know, like that's it. But it's like, that's the same thing a musician does. Like if they, you know, writer's block is the worst thing. So brewer's block is totally a real thing too, and you know, you want to be able to feel like, if you feel any relative inspiration, to be able to go ahead and go with it. And that's what's great about this job, is that you're encouraged to do that. You're encouraged to feel inspired.
Yeah.
Which is very rare in most jobs. They want you to just hit numbers and do this step to that step.
But it's like you're just a robot every day.
And like what you said with the notable, like the other thing I like about that idea is it's less about, I mean, it's cool to have a different beer that people can try and stuff like that. Yeah. But what seems like the important thing about that is it forces everybody to be constantly be thinking about a new thing. So even if you make one and you're like, ah, this didn't turn out well, or even if you feel stuck, it's that constant, like, you are, like, when you're listening to the radio, you're like, oh, beer, beer, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And we have such a good diverse staff here, too. It's like, you know, myself, the three co-owners are myself, Todd, and Susie. And Todd and Susie basically founded the place up. I'm the first, like, to become a co-owner besides them. And we're at different stages of our lives and stuff like that. So, like, certain things stimulate us differently. And it's like, and the different, we have our production staff ages anywhere. I think I'm the oldest at 32, but we have a guy as young as 23, you know, and of all walks of life and stuff like that. And they get inspired in different ways, and we encourage them to like make suggestions and ideas for not just how we run things, but also for you know, random brews and stuff like that. And like, it's stuff like, I'll be like, I want to make this big giant imperial stout and barrel aged in four different barrels with different spices in all of them, and have one called fear and the other one called pain and the other one called hatred. and basically the idea, like, there's a I'm a metalhead, so there's like a Lamb of God song called Ruin, and it's like, I'll teach you all that, mastered fear, pain, hatred, power, this is the art of ruin. I have all of those called that, and they have a blend of them and call that the art of ruin, and I'm like, that's so freaking awesome. And then like Todd will come down and be like, what about a Kolsch? You know, like, well, that sounds good too, you know. But then that's what I say, like, it's like our mindsets are in different spots sometimes. We determine on what we feel like getting into at that time. So it's good because, like, it allows us to have, you know, there's people that in the middle of this heat will still want to drink a Russian Imperial Stout. And there's people that are in the middle of this heat that would normally always drink IPA, and they're like, screw it, give me a Rattler. Like, I don't want anything but this. So it's like, you're never going to get a constant in the craft beer drinking crowd. Mm-hmm. You're never going to get constant in people. In general, there is no one answer.
And the dark beer guys are going to appreciate being able to get dark beer in the summer when they can't.
That's why we keep Coco Loco as a year-rounder. You know, it's just, you know, and it sells oddly well during the summer. You would never think it would, but it's because it's like, you know, one of the few standard dark beers that doesn't ever leave the tap handles. So, yeah, and one of my favorite, I was actually just hanging out with a guy who was telling me that the Coco Loco was the beer that got him into craft beer.
Oh, nice.
That's awesome.
Now he's working compliment. Through. Yeah, I hear a lot of those in like the Ghost Hop or the Cavu, or like, it's all these, like, and none of them like have this consistent, like, oh, it's light ABV and it's really easy to get. No, it's like Coco Loco is a 6.2% robust porter with coconut and coconut nibs in it. Like it's not like a, hey, if you want to try craft beer for the first time, jump into this deep end over here. It's like, it's not a stepping stone here, but that was like the beer that just hooked this dude. And he's like, I love it. Now I drink nothing but porters and stouts and brown ales, and I blend different ones together. And stuff like that. So it's so cool to hear that sort of thing, because no one, there's never, like I said, there's not a consistency.
Well, I think a lot of people don't get into craft beer because they think of beer as something that's much more basic than it can be. You know?
Yeah,
and so a lot of times you'll start like, oh, well, you like Bud Light, like, you know, here's your gold nail.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, there's nothing wrong with those stepping stone beers. I mean, like, that's kind of like what our Cabu is, but it's still a beer we're really proud of.
Yeah.
You know, it's a beer that we still use really good quality ingredients into it. And it's just like we'll brew pilsners and stuff like that. But there's just this. I mean, if you tell people what goes into macro beer, they probably don't. It would not change their sales. Macro beer still has enough.
Yeah,
they can price their stuff lower than we'd ever be able to, and
it's
going to sell.
Yeah.
But that's fine. But I think a lot of people, I hate, and it's changing here, at least. They still go to parts of the state and parts of the country where it hasn't changed at all. But like the fact that it's changed here, where NASCAR's influence is really heavy, and nothing against NASCAR, but NASCAR is heavily funded by macro beer.
Right, absolutely. And
which is
what
really did stunt, I think, the blossoming of Charlotte. I think that's why it's the last of the big cities in North Carolina to become a craft brewery spot, because there's so much. You cannot put a value on nostalgia.
Yeah.
You know, there's like if you grow up in race country and you you know, you had your very first beer with your dad on the there's nothing wrong with that at all. And I'm not a snob. I'll never tell you that you're wrong for liking what you like. I'll just give you reasons why you should try what I think is good.
Yeah.
But so like, you know, you have all that. Like the thing that I hate about it is that there was a standard in Charlotte where people would be like, they would come up to the brewery right when we first opened, like, what beers do you have that are normal beers? Like, what's the normal
beer? What's your lightest
option? And I'm like, you do realize that what you consider normal beer is basically the most bastardization of what normal beer is, right? Yeah. It's like, if you want to drink 49.9% corn syrup fermentated, you know, beer, that's fine.
Yeah, here's your Miller Lite.
I see a red dot on me. That's not enough. But that's the honest truth, you know. And it's like that's how you mass produce beer for nothing, you know, for very low cost. You just you add adjunct that's quick, easy, fermentable. But yeah, you were trying to say something earlier. I rambled.
Yeah, it was a stepping
stone.
It was a stepping stone. No, I think it's cool that you have those beers that make people realize like craft beer. Mm-hmm. Isn't what people are used to growing up on. Like, I say this all the time, but I grew up in New Jersey, and we like to call it the craft beer desert, because there's really, like, nothing around. And after, like, moving here, Jeff handed me Wicked Weed's Black Angel.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy crap, this is a beer?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, this is what beer can be. And since then, I've just dived into every other style, and it just blows my mind.
Yeah.
It still does after a year and a half. I go into a different brewery, and they'll have, like, 16, 20 taps, and everything is so different.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that.
Yeah. It's not always just the same, like, oh, we just have an IPA, but we have this IPA with peaches and Brett and apricot and all this you know, crazy shit. Like, there is a beer for everyone. For anyone who says, oh, I can't find anything I like, there's a beer out there. I swear there's a beer out there for you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. How do you approach adjuncts? Like, what are your... Do you kind of say, oh, I want to make this type of beer, and then these adjuncts would add to it? Or you'd be like, oh, man, like, I really want to make like this fruity thing, and then I'm going to make my grain build around this idea? Or
it totally depends on the beer.
Okay.
Like, there are certain beers that you absolutely have to have a certain amount of adjuncts in. You know,
yeah.
It's like, you look at, like, brewing saisons, like, basically the entirety of what you should be having fun with on that beer, besides letting the yeast go ape shit. Sorry, I don't know how much cussing you guys
are. Oh, you can swear.
It should be like how much like adjunct character kind of with, are we going to go with rye? Are we going to go with flaked wheat? Are we going to go with, you know, wheat malt? Are we going to do like, you know, oats on it? Or, you know, what are you going to do? We've used corn, and so we did a Mexican lager and corn and so like that. So like when you approach certain styles, you kind of like, you know, you're going to want to have certain adjunct in it. The most fun I think I had with adjuncts, as far as like it wasn't absolutely necessary for the book related style, but like it was definitely needed for the cultural style, was when we did the Goodwill hopping for the Northeastern IPA. Whereas that whole, it's not considered a style yet. I don't know if it ever will, to be honest with you. But like that whole like way of making the IPA is heavily based on high adjunct additive and no real specialty malt.
Yeah.
So you know, it's like I'm making an IPA, but with none of these normal things. we use at our old spot, we do a lot of locally malted Epiphany malt, and it is done in Durham. So we had that base, and then we had wheat malt, and flaked oats, dextrin in it as well, and I think triticale as well. So, you know, we had, so that was the grain bill. And it's like, you know, when you're making an IPA, you know, like your stereotypical like West Coast IPA, it just doesn't look like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's part of it. I like weird adjunct stuff. I mean, we have coconut beers and we have all these other things. But my biggest goal when doing, really honestly, any beer is, there's this like kind of weird, like I like my session beers to not taste like they're sessionable.
Okay.
I like my adjunct beers to taste still like they're the base beer.
Yeah.
I like my imperial beers to taste like you can drink them all day,
mm-hmm.
which is a great thing to find out that
yeah.
you can't. Like one of my favorite beers ever is when we did our bourbon barrel aged Old Voyager, which is our bourbon barrel aged English barley wine.
Mm-hmm.
And people were like, "That's just so smooth, it's so good." I was like, "Yeah, it's 10.5%
alcohol." 2 beers in, you're like, "Oh,
this
shit.
Is like get like three snifters in, and they're like just fall over." who I call our littlest one is Mindy. I think she's 22 now. She's 21 when she started working with us, and she did like some bartending stuff. She handled some of our account ordering and stuff like that. And she came up to, she's like maybe 90 pounds if she's soaking wet with like five tied around her neck, and you know, and she's like, "I have a problem," and I'm like, "What's wrong?" And she's like, "Say, I don't like barley wines usually." I'm like, "That's awful. I'm sorry to hear that." And she's like, "That's not my problem." She's like, "I really like your Bourbon Barrel Aged Old Voyager." I'm like, "Cool, I don't know why this is a problem." She's like, "I can't drink more than 3 glasses of it, and I'd be carried home." I'm like, "We need to make a sign that's just you. It's like you had to be this tall or above."
You have to weigh this amount.
I was like, "Mindy, if I can shot put you across our parking lot, you are not allowed more than one snifter of that."
Yeah.
It's like, But like when it comes down to like the way that the beers are made in general, I like them to be like, I like them to feel more accessible than you anticipate them should.
Right.
Should. Like I'm really happy with our Par 4 Session IPA.
Part 4 is amazing.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah, I'm really happy. It took a lot of tries to really get that to where I wanted it, because a lot of the first like kind of generations of session IPAs kind of lacked a back end on them, or they were so dry or astringent on the finish. It's like it's always either like too much back sharp characteristic or just complete vapidness, and there's just nothing that really developed.
Yeah.
They're not just ours, but a lot of other breweries have gotten really, really good at fixing that problem since that point. But it's like it was hard to nail down like how to make it have a backside character but stay at 4% but still not be too much. And so,
right.
So,
you can drink it and it doesn't wreck your palate.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Time, it
so,
still
yeah.
tastes like an IPA.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, that beer has as much hops in it as Hop Drop and Roll does, and it's 4% alcohol. You know, it's almost half the grain bill. So, you know, it's a lot of hops going on. But you know, to make a beer that tastes like that but it'll be only 4% alcohol, and on the flip side of it, have a beer that's like, you know, just a smorgasbord of malt like the barley wine is, and have people sit there and say that they could drink it all day, and I'm like, "No, you cannot." I love that feeling, because like there's nothing, like I love barley wines, and there's nothing worse than sitting there drinking a barley and you're like, "This is amazing," and you're like halfway through your glass and like, "I need an insulin shot," you know. It's like you can't get through it, and that's why they're special occasion beers. But I also hate saying like, "Yeah, I'll have that 3.5% blah blah blah," and you start drinking it and you're just like, "It was okay," you know, and like, or like, it's just like there's not a whole lot of pizzazz to
there's
it.
There's not a lot going on,
And I think that I've been saying for at least 2 years that the session IPAs with full flavor is like the new big thing to hit.
Yeah.
As far as industry impactful, that's where it really should be, and that's why the session IPA I think has been so big. So to give you reference, session IPA is the largest submitted initial year category of all time.
Huh.
So what that means is like the first year in which it
was
available
style.
As a style,
it
was the highest amount of entries, period. It was the third biggest style, I think, at the Great American Beer Festival this past year.
That's insane.
And it was its first year ever as a style.
Wow.
Like when Berliner Weiss became a style, they're like, with 7 entries, it is. Session IP is like with 187, you know, entries.
Yeah.
It's like it's. I don't think.
I think it's something people want, especially with like more beer festivals popping up and stuff.
Yeah.
You don't want to go to a beer festival and just get sloshed and then not be able to taste beer or drink.
Exactly.
Beer.
You want to be able to try everything and not like four beers.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I was saying, I think that says a lot about the consumer, is that we've reached a point that we would rather drink one or two really great quality beers than just start pounding like watered down beer just for the sake of saying that we're drinking a beer.
Absolutely. I think that's valid, but I think that's I think what it's come from here in our local culture in general is that it evolved from like
we're gonna pound beer and stand upside down on a keg or whatever. And like, it's like the faster you can drink it, the less you have to taste it, sort of mentality.
It definitely feeds into it.
Yeah, so yeah. That feeds into it. But then it like on the flip side of it, when in the craft beer underbelly, they're like we're gonna sit and share this one, you know, 22-ounce bomb,
yeah,
this bourbon barrel aged stout or whatever, and sip on it with our
2 hours of glasses.
Blah, blah. You know, and then that came with like this kind of quasi stigma of like, not really necessarily snobbish, but like it kind of put in like the higher wine quality echelon sort of mm-hmm. mentality.
Yeah.
And now I think it's been, and it should have been, well defined, is that there's such a good rainbow of stuff out there that you can have like your special occasion beers that people freak out about, trade heavily, but
yeah.
also there's this
yeah.
equal freak out on the insanely good session beers. And
right.
The ones that you can pound
yeah.
over
yeah.
and over again.
You
because
horseshoes. You can,
yeah. yeah, yeah. But it's like you look in the summertime and you have, especially here where you have all these, like, you know, you can go to the Whitewater Center or, you know, be on the river or the lakes or whatever, and people go on boats and for hours, like, just drink entire, like, packs
yeah.
and cases of beer.
Yeah.
And still be, you know, not drowned at the end of the day.
Yeah. yeah.
You sit there and, like, you drink, like, what everyone was freaking out about. You know, there's, I think, you know, if I go back, like, 7 years or 8 years, you know, you had a lot of breweries that were coming into North Carolina that were, you know, like, oh, here's our pale ale, and here's our wheat beer, and here's our wit beer, blah, 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 and here's our double IPA, guys. It's all freaking out. You know, like, and that was, like, their trump card all the time.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
like, you get people equally excited about, like, oh, I heard that session IPA was really freaking
yeah.
out.
Yeah.
Well, that 3% sour is out of this world or whatever. And the sour game really helped that out. The fact that you could have beer that really highly appealed to wine drinkers because of its acidic quality. And then you also have the fact that you could actually drink them for a fairly long period of
right.
time.
Yeah.
You wouldn't chug sour beers, although I have done it.
Yeah. But you can drink it at the same speed you would like a soda.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You
can sip on it and enjoy it like it's a fine beer, but it's not going to wreck your day.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the first, I think, big genre that came out as in, like, this is a big fancy beer to drink, but it didn't come with the high ABV value to it, unless you're drinking Cascade stuff, and they like everything's like 9, 10% Actually, our first official large production sour is a 9% sour, so, cha-ching. Which one of my favorite names I ever came up with is Stop, Collaborate, and Glisten. It's a sparkling Belgian strong sour that we did with a Night Shift up in Boston. We did our first one up there with them, and we did a 30 barrel version of it here, so it's sitting at the original spot right now, actually.
Do you name most of the beers?
Yeah, or we have a big group meeting and just kind of start throwing them out and just like kind of unanimously agree. I have to scrap a lot of my more demon death metal music.
Yeah.
Well, Monster, very clever.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Monster. I do like puns, and I do try to run. I tend to run our Noda name into high usage a little bit more than I should. Like, I like Noda Hito. It just works.
That's great.
Notarized, I thought, was a really cool pun. So a lot of them kind of start out in the.
At least they're not name. Hot puns.
Except yeah,
true.
Drop them,
yeah,
that was actually Todd who did that.
Yeah.
That's
a good
one.
That's
a
brilliant
name.
No one can play off of it.
Yeah.
Because then now it's yours.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do like
yeah.
the slogan, like, consider yourself notified.
Yeah.
It's fun with that. But it's one of those few names left in Charlotte that's an area that can easily be used as a name. So
yeah.
Which is, it sucked because we found out that like we were really wrong on that concept. It's like locally in North Carolina, it's cool. It's like, oh, we're in this arts neighborhood in Charlotte. When we go to nationwide festivals, like, we're in North Dakota, are you guys from? And we're like, oh, crap, we do. Like, we're right from North Carolina. Like, we're nowhere close to this. Sorry, it's a little town. That's a street. yeah, so the naming is pretty fun, but this it sucks when you get like a writer's block. Like next week's notable is a Kolsch, and I was like struggling on the Kolsch name, and then someone like just punned it into like being the first part of the word caution. So Kolschen. So I don't even know which one it's going to be. I told the guy who filmed the video for, I was like, pick whichever one sounds better on the video, but it's either proceed with Kolschen. A cautionary tale. So, yeah, so
don't forget.
Just, yeah, so
don't
stuff like that. Like, they just sometimes they just come to you. But like, and that's the thing with like the making the new beers. Like, sometimes like the beer itself comes, and then sometimes like the name comes first. And like the name itself can embody completely what the beer is trying
yeah.
to be.
Yeah,
so
that's kind of what we do. We usually don't name our beers until So we try them. For the most part. Unless it's like an adjunct or something.
Or do you guys do like the Doctor Who series too, though?
That's very true.
The problem with that with us is like if we're going to try, like a lot of our one-offs are now actually going to be available in market. So we brew them at the 15-barrel system. So it's like something you have on Tuesday may actually be available in a handful of like small accounts that are like really diehard good accounts of ours. Which is cool, but we need to have label approval
for
it. So we have to submit the name, submit the ABV, and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes they're mid-fermentation when that happens. So like, let's hope it tastes like this. it doesn't run it out with that. So they don't make it easy for us with the laws and everything. So, but
what's like the weirdest thing you've ever put in a beer? Whether or not
it's actually being served right now at our original location. We inherited a beer. I emceed a blog for the North Carolina Fantasy Brewers Draft, which benefits Pints for Prostate, which is my favorite charity here locally in Charlotte, because it's literally the one that is responsible for me being in the beer industry. The guy who founded it, Rick Like, the prostate cancer survivor, and used to live down the road from me and my one of my best friends who works for us now, actually as our accountant, Charles. And he basically, me and Charles were his like adopted grandchildren, and he just like basically pushed us into the beer world because he's a writer for beer blogs.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so basically, we traveled around the country with him doing these beer events, and I met Sam Calagione, met Garrett Oliver, met Jim Cook and Greg Cook and all the who's who of the beer industry.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I was like really cutting my teeth on it, so like I got submerged from him and got to speak to the idols about, you know, how beer should work, et cetera. So I owe a lot to where I'm at to them. And also I think it's a good cause. So we're doing a benefit down there right now for them. What the fantasy draft was, basically, I have a character I play a lot of times on YouTube called Don Burgundy, which is my Ron Burgundy impersonation, basically. He's basically a little chauvinistic, like, drinking all the time. It's pretty great. I love doing it. I do have to wear a mustache pretty hardcore for, like, a week after I do that, though. And I emceed the event. We were going to host the event originally, but just because of productions, we weren't going to be part of the brewing on it. And basically the idea is, like, there's 12 different breweries, and they do, like, a fantasy draft thing, but instead of drafting players for, like, the NFL draft, they draft ingredients. So they get a base malt, two specialty malts, two hops, they draw a yeast at random out of a hat, and they get like three whatever the heck they want to come up with. And it's basically once something is pulled, it's only for that one brewery.
Yeah.
So it's kind of it's in a rotation of like, you know, what can people come up with. So one of the breweries dropped out, and with 9 days left to go till the tapping of it, we're like, we'll step in. And I was like, will we? Is that okay? Cool, awesome. All right, let's get in. With the beer that we got was like Golden Promise base malt, flaked barley, pale chocolate malt, American Ale 2 yeast, Northern Brewer hops, Pacific Jade hops, dark Belgian candy sugar, Fun Dip, and Pop Rocks. I was like, what are we supposed to do with this? So I made a Northeastern style IPA. I just dry hopped the crap out of it with Jade, like over and over again. And it's like this cloudy mess or whatever. But and then basically, while the boil was going, we're just dumping Fun Dip and Pop Rocks. We're like, we don't know what this is going to do. Like the Krausen ring. I'll actually show you this. The Krausen ring on the
first. Was it all like brightly colored?
It was blue. It was straight up blue.
It
was ridiculous. So, yeah, that was the Krausen ring on right there.
Oh, geez.
So this bluish green. Yeah. It's not very appetizing at all. But I mean, the beer turned out actually weirdly decent, I guess. I don't know. It's hard to truly see. But, you know. It's weird to do that. I've thrown graham crackers in. There was an article that came out that said I cried in every hop drop and roll batch. It's probably true. I don't know. I get emotional. I've thrown a lot of weird adjuncty sort of things in. There's us. The weirder the stuff is usually the rarer that it actually will come out in the beer or whatever. But oddly enough, that Fun Dip definitely had an impact on that beer. That's probably the weirdest thing I put in general.
Okay. Did not expect that.
Yeah, I want to try that.
Do you know how I went to 14 places to find Fun Dip and Pop Rocks?
Really?
They do not carry them anywhere.
How much did you have to get?
It was a 15-gallon batch.
Okay.
We got six sleeves of Fun Dip and like like two bags of Pop Rocks, and we actually garnish the glasses with the
Pop
Rocks.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is actually horrifying, because when you eat Pop Rocks, you're like, no, it's going to sit in my tongue, and it sparkles in my mouth. When you drink something, it flings the Pop Rocks in the back of your throat, so it feels like your neck's getting electrocuted. It's fun. It's so delicious. Like, no, it's not. It feels like you're dying. So it's called Wonka's Hangover Inducer Elixir. Yes.
Beautiful. It's good. It's good.
At this point, Willy Wonka, Candy Factory, Miller, and Guinness are all trying to kill me, I think.
Willy Wonka's Nestle, too, so that's a big one.
Oh, I know. They have guns.
It's like the Pop Rocks and Coke myth.
Yeah.
Just the Pop Rocks on your beer.
Yeah. No, they do release a lot of CO2. And they don't actually make it foam up as much as you think it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's way more CO2 in, I don't make soda, but I think there's way more CO2 that's free based to release in a Coca-Cola than there is in beer. We were dropping them in there to test it, because we thought it was just over foam like crazy. And it's cool, because you can see the little pebbles, candies, just like giving off tons of gas. Yeah. And it just makes the head just kind of get more stable, but it doesn't like over foam it at all. Yeah. So I was kind of surprised.
That's cool.
Cool. Yeah. So that event is going on right now at the old location, and there's an event going on right now at the new location.
Yeah, we have the Finders Keepers. We do it every other Sunday. We've been doing it for a couple months now, and basically it's a bunch of like local craftsmen basically put up booths and sell and showcase their wares, everything from jewelry to like dog accessories and stuff like that.
It's pretty cool. It's kind of eclectic.
Yeah, and we're like, that's our thing. Like, we're very neighborhood drived, and I live 3 blocks away from here.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, we're all part of the community, and you know, we want to give back to the community, et cetera, and stuff like that, and showcase different parts of it. And if you don't, you don't have an identity like where you are, or where you came from, or anything like that, then it's just you're just kind of putting words on paper. There's no backbone to it. So, you know, I it makes it really easy. Like, tomorrow I'll be in by 4 a.m. mashing in and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, I appreciate the fact that I live in Noda, that I can drive 2 minutes up the road to start up. If it was some other place, you know, then it would suck. But also, it's like, after work, I know I can go to a handful of spots that is the community that I go to get my food, to get my drinks and stuff like that, and hang out with people that I see all the time through our tap room and everything like that. So it is a very community-based thing. That's what craft beer has always been founded on, is the community idea. When you go outside the state, it's awesome, it's cool, and you get to kind of like bring a little bit of what inspired you back home to another location, but like your foundation, your backyard is always, in my opinion, should be the conceptual engine of what you're trying to push out. So like, that's why a lot of people are like, why can't we get you in, you know, this part of the state over and over? It's like, well, one, there's the cap of production, but two, and most importantly, our backyard will always come first, because that's what's made us.
Yeah,
I was gonna say, how far actually out of Charlotte area do you actually get?
We self-distribute basically the greater Mecklenburg County area.
Okay.
But we have anybody that's willing to drive down to pick up cans, and there's some accounts that can pick up kegs too. It's kind of like we have like a grace period of like, you know, like we own our kegs, so they have to be a pretty solid account, to the point where it's like, we rely that you will bring them back on a regular basis. But as far as Asheville and as far as Wilmington,
okay,
then we have people that come in
pretty much across the whole state.
And it's just a couple of spotty spots. There's a couple of spotty areas of North Carolina where you'll find us in semi-regularity. Like the one that I know the most, because I'm from Chapel Hill, is a beer study in Carrboro.
Okay.
They come in all the time, pick up and get kegs and everything like that too. So, you know, it's just, there's certain accounts that just are really good about just circling by like every week and just picking up stuff. And there's several in Raleigh, and there's several in the Triad area and stuff like that. The best bet, if you want to find our stuff and you don't live in this area, is just to give them a call or give us a call. And like, you'll probably get Mindy, our littlest one. and she'll say like, oh yeah, so-and-so picked up, you know, this morning. So then call that guy and like, yeah, we'll have him on the shelves tomorrow morning or whatever. You know, so unfortunately, like, you know, when you come down with one little van or like an SUV, you're not going to get a month's load of a hop drop or par four or whatever you're going to get. So, and since it's a rarity in that area, a lot of people that frequent usually kind of scoff it up pretty fast. So
that's what happens in our area.
Yeah.
Most
of the beer shops will post like, we got Hop Jump and Roll in, like, get it while it lasts, because we're not going to go for another month or so.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, it's unfortunate that it's that way, but again, it's like, we can't send our own trucks that far out to hit up a few spots.
Just a couple of pigs. It's not worth it.
It's not financially worth it for it. So, So yeah, so we take care of our backyard, and luckily that's the beauty about being, and everything's relative. So it's like, you know, in Charlotte we have over 500 accounts. You know, it's like we can take care of that. It's all 15-minute drive at most for us.
Yeah.
You look at our friends over at Mother Earth in Kinston. I don't know if you've been to Kinston or not, but there ain't much there. There's Mother Earth, and then there's houses.
So they really
They got to reach really far. So like, it makes no sense for them to load up their own truck and drive it for 3 hours to drop off four kegs. They've lost money in that, basically. Yeah. So like, from day one, they're like, we're going to go with the distribution company and go statewide. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. You know,
because there's no reason for them to self-distribute in their media. With us, it makes sense. So it's really case-dependent on which we did. Old Mech's the same way. I mean, Old Mech was the first brewery to really come in after the last big production brewery fell, which was like 15 years ago or whatever. You know, so they were the ones that kind of proved that you could actually have a brewery in Charlotte. They're about 2 years older than we are. You know, and us and them are the big self-distribution ones. We'll both hit like the 25,000 barrel cap within this year or early next year. So, you know, we're fighting to try to lift that cap so we can produce more and get some more beer out there in wider bases. In Charlotte itself, there's so many bars. There's so much local support in the bars nowadays, like, you know, six, seven years ago.
There's no point in even leaving.
Yeah, it doesn't pose any benefit to us other than just a broader span of people knowing about it.
Yeah.
But with the advent of social media, there's no point in that anyway. It's pretty easy to find out. So,
do you find you have a lot of support in the movement to raise the cap?
Yeah, I think we do. A lot of the local breweries are totally for it. A lot of local breweries that are signed with distributors that can't kind of vocalize it are also kind of like, yeah, that's a good idea. There's no real logical reason why that cap really should exist. And it's not against distributors. It's just against the idea that we can't have the conversation to make a sensical like agreement on like how the beer does get out to the masses. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, it's just like, once you're this, all your beer has to be distributed by someone.
Yeah. Then you have no control of how it's
distributed.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, well, then I have to fire a third of my company too. My entire delivery team's gone. There's no point for them.
Yeah.
You know, most of my marketing people have no point either, because if it's going to be sales reps in every single spot for the distributor, there's no point.
Yeah.
You know, so distributors have an absolute like reason to be. You know, they have a good purpose in the community and in the beer industry as a whole and in a local sense. But right now we don't need them.
Yeah.
But when we do want to have them, you know, we want to be able to have a conversation with them. But the way the law is now, there's no
conversation. Especially if you're like, hey, help us grow instead of like taking over what we're
doing. And honestly, the distributors,
well.
Like most of the distributors I've talked to, they tend to like the idea of it. It's just they have such a great angle on that side of the law. They're not going to change our hand up.
Yeah, yeah. Let's lose us money.
I can't blame them for not losing their stance on it or anything like that. I mean, it makes total business sense on their end of it. It just doesn't make business sense on our end of it. So it's just another arcane law. You know, that's kind of the song of the South. It's like, it is what it is. We're very, we've gotten really good support for it. And, we have lots of different spots in all the major cities of North Carolina that want that law to be lifted so they can get some more regular available beers and stuff like that. So it's just a process. You know, we gotta take it one step at a time. And it's got more traction now than I think it ever has. It's more aware of the general public. It's been fought for years. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but like the Red Oak self-distributors.
Yeah, Red Oak's been,
they've been fighting it for like 20 years.
So they just put up a electronic billboard right in front of the brewery like a week ago, and it has blasted, you know, craft freedom and everything.
They're definitely supporting it. So yeah,
the more people know about it, the better.
Exactly. So it's and it's yeah it's the biggest problem I have with it. The two biggest problems is that there's the whole lack of the whole ability to just make the business call yourself as an individual business, which just makes sense. In business terms,
being able to sell your own stuff.
Yeah. Well, being able to talk some like we want to sell further. What do you offer to the table? You know, it's like, well, we offer this, and at this point, you can control that, and we control this, blah blah blah. And so let's converse,
right?
As opposed to just like you hit this arbitrary number, all your stuff now has to be sold, or you're gonna be penalized. It's like, well, that's not how it'd make more sense to me if you're like, now the government has to distribute all your stuff, because that's what the government's doing, is saying that you have to sell to a private industry to sell your private industry's stuff. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. Like, it makes more sense if the government would then just distribute. I don't want that either. But, you know, but that would at least make logical sense. Right, once you hit a certain volume, the government has to distribute it. But the government says, like, no, once you hit a certain volume, then your private party has to then sell the marketing rights and all delivery rights to another private party. It's like, well, why don't those two private parties talk it out and figure out what's best for both of us? You know, it's like, that's what I like. The other big problem with it, too, is that like it kind of encourages the whole macro-controlled saturation thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so that anything with, you know, that's the giant's foot standing over everybody, and they feel more threatened every year and year and year as they grow in larger numbers and larger support and larger awareness. You know, they get a little bit more antsy, I think. But I don't think that they're freaking out too much now, but I'd rue the day when they do. They have more power. They have more money than most governments do. So you know, it's one of those things where it's like we fight them from, you know, from person to person, glass to glass.
Yeah,
you know, we can't take them on much other fronts than that, in my opinion. But you know, that's where it starts, is the individual mind. So.
Yeah.
Well, do you guys have any events coming up that you want our listeners to know about?
I wish I could tell you, but it's coordination stuff.
Where can they find out about events that you guys are coming up?
Just notabrewing.com. And sign up on our Facebook feed. We have an Instagram account. We have Twitter feeds also. And we have a newsletter, too, that actually features my lovely YouTube videos every week that lets you know about each weekly beer and also special occasions and events. We're doing like the 26-point brew right now, which is a marathon training thing. We did a collaboration with our local kombucha and brewery, Lenny Boy. For that, it's a beet saison. So we did that specifically for the training for the marathon.
Yeah,
it's really cool. Like, you know, we have a ton of events. This new facility has a ton of potential for events. So it's basically every couple of days we have something new coming
up. Awesome.
So check it out on the website. And also, if you do the newsletter, it will be listing out literally everything in the next couple of weeks that's going on that concerns NOTA will be listed right there.
That's good.
And our YouTube channel is there. I think we have the record for the most YouTube videos with the least amount of actual views. I think it's like 160 some odd videos. This is me just like blabbing about a random ass beer. But it's entertaining, especially seeing, like, if you go way back and just watch like the old videos as they come through, because like we used to do everything as like a full on like skit. That's because we had way more time to kill back then.
Yeah,
it was like now I'm like, all right, we got 20 minutes. Film me talking about in front of this tank. And
I'm glad you guys kept up doing that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I really like doing it, in all honesty. And, like, I did the TEDx talk a couple years ago, so that's part of it.
Yeah.
We had a documentary DVD made of us as well. And like, there's been a lot of like kind of like progressively more like social media video based sort of stuff that I've kind of stemmed off of that or incorporated and everything. But I was inspired by Avery and Dogfish Head back before we opened, because they like Sam's Quick Sips that he would do, which was like he would just take like, he'd be like swing around in his chair, he's like, so this is Namaste. Talk about it a little bit. He'd tell you like why he thought of that and what the beer tastes like and stuff. And I'm like, that's cool, because he's giving you it's the guy who owns the company.
Yeah.
Like telling you what's about the beer. Like, my favorite one is like, he's in the bocce court telling you about old school. And he gets the whole thing about old school and then just starts running down the bocce court like randomly, like a madman. And like, that's cool, because you get like to see the people, and Avery did it from different staff members in different parts of the region. You get to see different parts of the brewery. You get to that. If you're outside of that state, you're not likely to ever see the barrel room or the can facility or the bottling facility. And so to see that sort of stuff and then talk to you by someone that actually made it, and give me the stats of what they think of it, what you should also expect from it. So like, that's awesome. So we did it, but then kind of went like, let's also give like character and backstory to each year. So like, let's do Batman parodies every year and some of that. So I've been the Joker and Bane and Two-Face so far. I haven't gotten this one. I really want to do Mr. Freeze, but I have my own like weirdness. I get too much into it like a lot of times. Like, I'm all about some costumes. So like when we did Two-Face, I had like a black and white suit on with like this black, white and gray crisscross like tie, and it was the dating game we did for some reason. I was like a contestant on the dating game, and I'm sitting there talking to one of the guys, and I turn to the camera and I have like this horrible scar all across my face, my hair's all frayed up, and I have a like blue contact in. I'm normally brown eyed for those who can't see me, but I like blue contact in, and I'm sitting there flinking the coin. I'm like, hello. You know, it's just stuff like that. Like, yeah, I really want to do I like doing them. They're fun, and it gives a little lightheartedness to it, and also you get to see the people that made the beer. So
yeah,
and a lot of those beers actually became production beers or seasonals and stuff like that. Like Notohito was one of them. Monk's Trunks was one. Par 4 was one. Like a lot of the stuff that you see now as regular, like staple available beers or seasonally available beers started out as notables.
Yeah.
And when we started, we had three beers: Rambon Red, Notarized, and Coco Loco. Those were our first three. Our first seasonal was Midnight Madness, and it was also our first notable. So it's like, you know, so stuff like that. Gorgeous was a notable. Like a lot of the beers that a lot of people just assume we just had in the back pocket all the time, or just came out as like just random little hodgepodge things that have a video that associates with them.
Yeah.
And everything too. So, so it's fun to kind of look back and be like, oh, that's where that came from, you know. Yeah. And you know, we just see different staff members, and I fight a lot of people in them. I'm relatively violent in my videos, I think. Which lets it out and everything, so yeah, it's fun. It just kind of gives a character to us, etc.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we'll definitely include that in the episode notes.
Yeah, and we'll start linking them once in a while on our Facebook. And for anybody listening, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Untappd, and Facebook. We're on iTunes and your, I guess, preferred podcast app. So please rate and subscribe. We really appreciate it. And is there anything else we need to mention?
I think that's it.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. And consider yourself notified.
Cheers.
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 Cheers, guys. Thank you.